motherfucker, you can live at the mall. I can see the evil, I can tell it, I know it's illegal. I don't think about it, I deposit every other zero. Thinking of my partner, put the candy, painting on a Rico. Digging in my pocket, ain't a profit big enough to feed you. Every day my logic, get another dollar just to keep you in the presence of your Chico. Ah! I don't talk about it, be about it, every day a sequel. If I got it, then you know you got it, heaven I can reach you. Pet dog, my dog, that's all. Pick back and chat, I trap the back for y'all. I rap, I black on tracks, so rest assured. My rights, my wrongs, I write till I'm right with God. When you know, we been hurt, been down before. Nigga, when our pride was low, looking at the world like, where do we go? Nigga, and we hate po-po, wanna kill us dead in the street for sure. Nigga, I'm at the preacher's door, my knees getting weak and my gun might blow, but we gon' be alright.
In my prayers,
I remember you was conflicted, misusing your influence. Sometimes I did the same, abusing my power full of resentment.
And good evening, Chuck Morse here at WMFO Medford. Welcome to the program, 855-915-WMFO, 855-915-9636. As I launch into yet another excursion of live radio here at Tufts University, it's great to be here, great to be doing the show. Love to be on the air at any opportunity I can. Let me just set things up here a little bit. Just some logistical issues here in terms of getting started. Of course, the program I should mention is live on YouTube, where it's also archived. And as technology being what it is, things move upward and onward all the time in this world, you know? Let's see here. Well, I'm certainly not. Here we go. Go live. There it is. Okay. Just clean that up. Well, that's not going to happen. Let me prop it up over here. There it is. Anyway, yes, you're listening to WMFO Left Right Radio with Chuck Morse every Thursday at 4 a.m. here at Tufts University. Recently, just as a program note, I should mention that let me just put my legal name in here. I've been doing, because I got this newfangled technology, I am doing a virtually daily, if not daily at this point, podcast, which also is up on YouTube. And the sound is great. I actually invested in a microphone at home. And so the show is going gangbusters, and my viewership is doubled. Okay, there's like a problem here recording the time here. That's because I got the zero wrong. Yeah, that's better. And so I'm really on a roll with that. And pleased to be doing it. So yesterday was election day. And certainly the Republicans were shellacked, as it were. I'm listening to some of the liberal radio hosts on the in here, and they sounded a little bit yesterday too. They're practically just drooling with joy and hyperventilating. Oh, this is a great day, a resurrection, or a reemergence for the left. And it very well may be. It wouldn't be a surprise given the unprecedented vitriol and hate that President Trump and those of us who support him have been subjected to. And meanwhile, this is a side note, but former President Obama was called in for jury duty in Chicago. And the atmosphere around that was similar to the atmosphere around his 2008 campaign, where it's almost like, you know, a cult worship to such a high decibel that is not really not really becoming in America. We generally have not worshipped people here. In 2008, women were fainting. Some women, I'm certainly not all, thank God, but there was a select number who were fainting in his presence and who appeared to be having like a some kind of a peak experience. Let's just put it that way. And this kind of stuff is seems to be coming back around him as the left looks for a new savior, a new great and glorious leader, you know, that can goose step into the sunlight and rescue the world, sort of like what they have in North Korea. And all the while they're like screeching about Donald Trump as being, quote, a narcissist, unquote. You know, this is the big mantra. And I think that their campaign of hate and vilification, and look, I recognize that unfortunately that's what American politics is all about. And, you know, they're going to project that onto us while they do it. But the thing that I wonder and I fear is whether or not that kind of politics has become is working for them. I mean, I think certainly in Virginia, and I'm not going to go into the details, but I mean, apparently they were running commercials where they showed the Republican driving a truck and running over black people and Muslims and women and gays and just, you know, this kind of hateful, truly vicious politics. You know, they run the ad for one day and then they pull it off saying, well, we don't know anything about who put the money up for this. But it works because it's out there for a day. I don't know if you remember. It's kind of like when George W. Bush ran and they ran the truck with the chains rattling on the back. And the voiceover of a woman who was a daughter of a man who had been murdered brutally by racists, basically saying that George W. Bush had killed her father, right? Or Mitt Romney, you know, during the healthcare debate. This guy gets on the television for a minute and he says, you know, Mitt Romney killed my wife. You know, this kind of politics is so vicious. And yet, it works in this era of media dominance where, due to advertising techniques, let's put it this way, going all the way back to the early part of the 20th century and the Edward Bernays book, Propaganda, who was hired by the Rockefeller family, and I believe he was a Rockefeller brother-in-law. He was an expert on conditioning, what they called, that they would use this sort of thing to manipulate people's emotions on a mass level, even if they're not necessarily conscious of it, and create a an indelible impression, one that's difficult to erase. At the same time, when they galvanize the sort of hatred that's really resides very deeply in the darker recesses of all of us, I suppose, and then uses that to manipulate people. I mean, it's that kind of politics that makes people react because, you know, when you go to the polls and you vote, and I mean, I've seen this in myself, and I'm not going to deny it. It's a part of human nature. You know, you try to vote responsibly in that you're voting for issues you care about. But there's also a little bit of trying to, you know, vent your anger, get revenge at someone because they said this or that. You know, people, it's almost like a it's like a theater of the mind, and it's a theater of life, in that people will tend to vote their own prejudices, you know, of all sorts. And I'm not talking here about ethnic prejudices. I'm talking about, you know, that somebody said something that reminded me of that person who stuck it to me years ago. You know, I'm going to get that person. You know, I'm going to vote for this one because I want to screw that one, and that kind of thing. And that's how, you know, that's what these ads appeal to. And I think they do so on a subconscious level. I also am wondering if whether or not the unprecedented campaign of vilification and hate that has been condoned, I'm not talking about this illicit stuff where they show the candidate running people over and killing them because he doesn't apparently allegedly like someone because of their ethnic background. I'm talking about the condoned hate that you hear spewing daily out of the press, out of the radio, and particularly radio, in that it was, you know, it has a more visceral effect because you hear it and you experience it as opposed to reading it, where it's a little bit more staid. Yeah, I mean, I know that these are not widely seen programs, but I'm going to give them as examples anyways because I listen to, you know, left and right radio, being the host of left-right radio myself. What the heck? And on the left, you have this constant, literal, and deliberate campaign really to destroy Trump and to overthrow the government. Now, they don't come out and advocate that openly, but they certainly walk pretty close to that envelope. On progressive radio, I would call out Michelangelo Signorilli as saying, I don't want to just, you know, not support anything. As a caller asked him once, it was a constant daily stream of rage against Trump. I've never seen anything like it. And he said, would you agree support something that the president wanted to support because you happen to also support that, even though it might be this president whom you obviously loathe? And his answer was, no, I will not support anything because I want him to go. I want him to go away. I want him to be taken out of office. Right? I mean, and to hell with the country. Just, I want him out. I want him gone. Or you have Dean Obadalla. I was just listening to him coming in. The guy was practically drooling with joy over this election. And I've listened to him consistently this past year. His thing is the race card. President Trump is a white supremacist. I mean, it's ridiculous and ugly and a racist. Doesn't like black people. Has something against black men and women, you know. Has something against Muslim men and women. Meanwhile, he's accusing conservatives of supporting Christian Sharia, I've heard him say today. I mean, what the heck is that? Really? Would he want to, you know, stack up Christian? Sharia is not a Christian concept. I don't want to go any further. This is Tufts Radio, so we'll leave it at that. Or you have Stephanie Miller and her gang that sit around with the most ugly, crude, vulgar comments about Trump, completely dehumanizing him and his supporters and tearing him down. Now, look, that's free speech, but it's taking a toll, I think. I mean, I've been listening to it. It's very demoralizing. It's very difficult to overcome it. To an extent, they would be doing this anyways to any conservative, certainly, or any Republican. They've been doing it since the days of Nixon. I'm old enough to remember the Nixon resignation. And the atmosphere around that was like a carnival. Nobody knew what Watergate was. They still don't know. It's this you know, strange scandal. But yet they knew that they despised him, and that, I mean, you had cartoonists drawing pictures of him, I mean, or political cartoonists, where they made him look really satanic, and where his eyes were blackened and just looked like a rat. And the kind of the smear campaign eventually drove him out of office. And I think that more recently that was occurring in the last couple of years of George W. Bush. Once the country had began to forget about 9/11 and, you know, the threat of terrorism, and certainly John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, I remember during the Halloween that year, seeing little girls dressed up like Sarah Palin in the most sickening and vulgar costumes. You know, these were like in nice, rich suburbs where most of these liberals live. But in the case of President Trump, it's really unprecedented. The absolute, you know, horrors of this. I mean, the loathing and the inflicted bile. It's very unhealthy, and it's really a sick thing for the society to have to experience. Now, as a conservative, and as an American citizen, and as a rational person, of course I'm critical of elements of Trump's personality, for sure, and agenda. You know, I think that he shouldn't be sending out all these tweets. I think it's bad. I wish he would stop it. Or at least I wish that he would sort of send out, I mean, some of them are very good, but I don't want to see him tweeting out things like, you know, telling football players that they shouldn't kneel, and you're getting into some of those issues. He doesn't need to do everything. He doesn't need to talk about everything. There are plenty of conservative pundits who could do that in a way that's much more effective and much more, you know, devastating. But he has this enormous ego. He's got some serious personality flaws. And he has, I think his intentions are right. I think his heart's in the right place. He wants to be involved in making statements on society. I just think he has to be very careful about it, because it can be and it is a distraction, and I think it is hurting him. So I wish that he wouldn't send tweets out on every little thing. It's not as bad as it was when he first took office and he was sending out his opinion on the television program with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, I don't want to hear about that. I don't care. I don't want to know what he thinks of that. It doesn't matter to me. He's the president of the United States. I want to hear about, you know, policy matters. I mean, if he must occasionally delve into a social issue, I don't like it. I think there are better ways to go about it. But I certainly don't want to hear about his opinion on some stupid television show. That was unfortunate. But having said that, I think that in a rational society where you have some balance, we would be able to put his peccadilloes, if you will, the negative aspects of his personality into a context and take a look at what he is supporting, which is something that I think personally would benefit all of America, but at least in a matter as an issue of public policy where you have reasonable debate, we ought to have a debate over it, which is something the left does not want to have, because they'll lose that debate. And it's really very concerning to me. I mean, it's scary to me that we're going to lose the focus on the issues that President Trump brought up, both as a candidate and as a president. And we're going to instead get wrapped up in these sickening, emotional, ugly attacks. It's really a concern for this is such an opportunity, having a president like this. It's unusual that we ought to not let it go. Donald Trump's election was an event of the century. It was unprecedented in American history. We need to understand that and appreciate it and foster it. And, you know, the attack against him by the regressive left who were just foot soldiers and stooges for, I think, an Eastern Seaboard establishment that includes the Republican Party, which, by the way, the Republican Party hated Reagan, too. They would have done this to Reagan if he hadn't been maybe a little bit more politically savvy than Trump. And that is, you know, the hate machine is driven on this idea that President Trump has something against minorities, which is a lie. It's absolutely a vicious, false accusation. It's a hateful one. It's one that we cannot let stand, because if we do let it stand, then it's going to be the kind of hate machine that can be grind up anybody who doesn't genuflect and zig heil and goose step to a left-wing agenda. We can't let that stand. For the left, of course, it serves the purpose of, and they actually, some of the more ignorant ones, frankly, they actually believe this. I mean, this is like an article of faith to them, that President Trump and his supporters, they've got something against black men and women. They actually believe this lie. You know, they sincerely have been swept up in their own propaganda. It's kind of like Harvey Weinstein and all these liberal pedophiles and sexual molesters of women. They got swept up into believing their own sexual revolution. I mean, they became a part of it. They didn't just view it as what it was, a tool to control people and to undermine Judeo-Christian moral and ethical values. They didn't see it. They knew they were practitioners of that, but they also got swept up in it themselves. In the same way, many people on the left actually have come to believe the propaganda that conservatives in general, President Trump in particular, they've got something against minorities. The really dangerous part of this is that it, and I think it started with Obama and his race divisions, which he exploited for political purposes, that it has damaged further, frankly, the minority community. It's riled them up in a way that makes them hateful. It makes them resentful rather than feeling positive about this country and they're realizing that you know, while we obviously do have race divisions in this country, that's part of life, and that certainly this country has had its share of sin in that regard, that great progress has been made. And instead of turning their resentments toward people like President Trump and Republicans, they might consider taking a look at some of the real causes of the distress that the minority community experiences today, particularly black people, and that is the left-wing policies that have hurt them and that have hurt their families, hurt their faith, hurt their entrepreneurialism, hurt them as people. They might take a look at some of those, which, of course, is not going to happen because they're too busy, just like the rest of us, or most of us, not me, but many people, getting swept up in the hate machine by turning their attention elsewhere, outside, and taking a look at President Trump and conservatives, who they're convinced has something against them. Why? That's never articulated, frankly. They don't know why. There is no coherent case that can be made for this. Did Donald Trump once say something insulting? Did he once look the wrong way? Sure. Let's take a look at everyone's house on that one. This is a free society, and we sometimes say things that are, you know, off the mark, and that can maybe even be hurtful. But are we going to hold that up and say, you see, this person, you know, believes in, you know, turning people back to slavery. I don't know. What do they think? You know, President Trump doesn't want to see black men and women advance in this country? I mean, really? Is that what he thinks? Is that what they claim? I mean, is there any evidence of that? I suppose I should just dwell on this just a little bit here and point out that the liberal community, the left-wing community, is really to blame, I would contend, for the racism and the destruction and the damage that has been done to the black community, particularly starting in the 1960s, when they really became enthroned and they really sort of began to achieve the high ground on policy. And, excuse me, YouTube viewers, I just had to call up an article here. And that is the destruction of the black faith starting in the 1960s. The black faith, the form of Christianity that black people embraced, was one of the most morally proper and spiritual of any in the Christian world. And in fact, I would argue that the black church actually revitalized the white church, if you will, and all white religion, you know, white people's religions, particularly Christianity, with its sense of grandeur and its centrality in the life of people and its belief and its fervency and its moral code. Black people were conservative. You know, they may, like any of us, none of us, we didn't live up to it, but they believed in the moral ethos and the moral code that came down from Sinai. They believed in it in a way that was greater than we could only hope to strive to believe. And the black church was mainly destroyed by the left, who replaced it with inchoate resentments and anger. The black business, I mean, it was just, you know, black families starting always, but certainly accelerating after World War II and right up into the 1960s, and today, obviously, had enormous entrepreneurialism. The black community was the penultimate example of American capitalism, creation of businesses, creation of enterprises and ownership and creativity. And this was in the face of real racism, Jim Crow laws, discrimination in the formal sense that people were told they couldn't work in companies because they were black. They couldn't go to certain colleges because they were black. They couldn't live in certain neighborhoods because they were black. I mean, we're talking about, you know, the kind of racism that you can only contemplate today. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine this, but really right up through the 1950s, I mean, I'm old enough to have been born during the time this was happening in this country. You had situations where black people were told, you can't come into this restaurant because we don't serve black people. I mean, can you imagine that? You want to talk about racism? I mean, you had Ralph Bunche. He was a special envoy from the United Nations, appointed by President Eisenhower, one of the most distinguished diplomats in this country. He actually brokered an armistice agreement between the State of Israel and Syria in 1948 at Rhodes, where he held a conference. I mean, we're talking about one of the great diplomats of American history, right? Great man. Ralph Bunche, who happened to be black, when you had foreign diplomats visiting Washington, he couldn't go out and have dinner with them because there might be a restaurant which didn't serve black people. I mean, that's how bad it was. That's how ignorant and how enshrined racism was back then. We're talking, again, this is 1950s era and before. And yet, in spite of that, the black community had an enormous growth in terms of their business and their capital accumulation and their integration into the economy, in spite of the kind of obstacles that we can only contemplate now. As of the 1960s, you had the black family, and that was damaged by the left. Let me make my point here. That was damaged by the left, who was anti-capitalist in the 1960s, where they burned down black neighborhoods in the guise of riots, when you had communist agitators coming out and burning cities like Detroit and Newark and whole neighborhoods that really haven't never recovered or are recovering slowly even to this day. And destroying black businesses. We saw a little of that more recently in Ferguson, Missouri, where under the guise of a riot, you had agitators burning down black businesses. These are businesses that black people had you know, been saving all their lives to develop. And, you know, they were great businesses, and they were destroyed, right? And you just had a negative anti-business atmosphere. You know, organizations like Acorn and other of these federally funded radical street organizations, they were protesting and keeping businesses from locating in black neighborhoods because they said, oh, they're capitalists. They're evil. So as a result, for example, in South Side of Chicago, you had Walmart decide, well, we're not going to come here and locate here because there was agitation on the part of Acorn. So they didn't. They went to another city, and the result is that they left behind an empty, garbage-strewn, rat-infested piece of land that has probably never been developed to this day. I'm giving one example here, right? When, in fact, what they could have had was a Walmart, which would have brought in other businesses as well, and which would have employed people and would have offered products to people at a lower price. And it would have generally been an improvement in the life of the people in that community. But because of this hateful, ridiculous, demented, anti-business approach, they said, fine, we'll go somewhere else. It's not worth it. It's not worth having to go through the struggle against this group. And they're not going to be blackmailed by this group. The left seriously damaged the black family. Daniel Patrick Moynihan in 1965 issued his famous treatise on the condition of the black family in America. He was the Assistant Secretary of Labor in the Lyndon Johnson administration at the time. And he pointed out that the black family was intact. It was faithful. It was about, I think it was like 80% of black families were together with a mother and a father and children, and that they were a solid, autonomous unit. I mean, the family is the greatest unit to stand up to state control, which is why the family has been under attack by the left, by the way. And that he advised that creating a national welfare system, which would have nothing to do with poverty, would have everything to do with redistributing the wealth, would have a damaging effect on the black family, which, again, was a great moral force. Now, I've read articles. I can't cite the exact article, but I did read one in a left-wing book. I have a huge library of these. Where this guy, this sociology professor, he admitted in this article openly, which is said what many people say indirectly, which is that the welfare movement in America, the nationalization of charity, if you will, had nothing to do with addressing poverty. It had to do with socialism. It had to do with redistributing the wealth. Everybody should get a paycheck, regardless of whether you're working. Everybody would have a, quote, job. This is what they did in the Soviet Union. Everybody got paid, right? I mean, the money wasn't worth much. You didn't have much to do except sit around and drink vodka, maybe. You know, it was a miserable, degrading degradation of the country and of the life. But everybody had a job, right? And it gets down to, frankly, a Marxist idea, which is that property ultimately has to be abolished and that all resources, which are finite in the Marxist lexicon, have to be equally distributed. I mean, of course, it's based on a false economic idea. The reality is that money or capital is not finite. It's infinite. Capital is as broad and as vast and as deep as the human being and the human mind, the ability to create, the ability to imagine. It's not a commodity. This is why I'm against the gold standard, but that's another subject. Money is simply an abstract expression of human potential and human activity. But to turn it into a commodity and say there's only just so much money in the world and so we have to redistribute it results in legalized theft. And it squelches the ability of human beings to create and to imagine and to do things that would invent and develop capital where it didn't exist before. And so you have this idea that somehow capital needs to be redistributed to minorities. And there were enough minorities who were willing to go along with it. And why not? If I had somebody banging my door and saying, hey, Chuck, come on out. We have money for you. I mean, yeah, of course you take it. I'm not criticizing them. I'm criticizing the concept, the government doing it, and the liberals who pushed this. Well, Daniel P. Monahan predicted that this would have a terrible effect on the black community and it would destroy the black family. And he was right. It did. The result was you had women who were basically given financial incentive to not get married and to drive the man out of the house. And then you had more financial incentives for having children out of wedlock. And the more children, the more money you got. This was something that was portrayed, I think, quite relatively accurately in a movie that came out a couple of years ago called Precious. Right? What that is. I mean, the children become commodities. They become paychecks for the mother. And the result is that you have children, particularly pretty males, growing up in a household with no father, with no positive male role model. And that combined with the economic dislocation that results from the left-wing anti-capitalist view, keeping businesses out, suppressing capital because it's evil for them, and the moral the pulling out of the rug morally from the church, which no longer teaches that there is a divine being and that there is a right and wrong, but instead is involved with some vague leftist concept that they call social justice. The result is that you have, and that I'll get into the fourth leg in the stool in a minute, which is education, but let me just finish the family piece. The result is that you have disaffected, alienated, angry, young black men who don't have a job and who really have nothing to do. So what do? They join gangs. Then, of course, you introduce drugs and you have liberal judges who give people a pass and let criminals out, and don't penalize people, the result is you have, obviously, an increase in violent crime and drug abuse and murder. The other aspect to this, the breakdown of the black family thanks to liberal policies of giving people a check, is education. The public schools, starting really in the early 20th century with people like John Dewey, the great progressive educator, and John Watson, the inventor of behaviorism, and several other so-called change agents, was that the education system and the modality of teaching was changed from one that was based on cognitive learning, where the young student would learn how to think for themselves. They would be given tools that would help them construct their own education. They would be strengthened with things like phonics as a way of learning how to read and how to think, you know, a natural method of learning arithmetic, which is a way of thinking in a way, in an organized manner. You know, these are things that, you know, a little bit of philosophies, you know, some may be studying the Constitution and how our government system works, and maybe even a little pride for of our nation, and, you know, some basic understanding of what sovereignty means, you know, maybe some skills in other areas like music, frankly, and other things. I mean, these things were replaced by behaviorism, which is to say that children were turned into psychological patients. Teachers were turned into psychologists. And instead of learning cognitively how to read, they would be taught, look, say methods. You'd look at a word, and instead of sounding it out with vowels and consonants, so you could read the word yourself in English, instead, you'd be taught to look at it like a flashcard. You know, you'd have to memorize it, basically, as a picture. And, you know, the result is, of course, that, you know, these words are not hieroglyphics. This is not, our system of reading is phonetic. It's not Chinese or Japanese, where the language is based upon a hieroglyphic system, which is fine for them because it works for them. But it's, you know, that's not what English is. English is a phonetic language. You have to sound out the words using vowels and consonants. You have to develop an impulse to do that, how to put these words together so you can read them on your own. They're not pictures. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when this look, say method was introduced into my school. I think I was in fifth grade or fourth grade, maybe third grade. And the teacher one day came in with these cards that was issued by the National Education Association, probably, where we had to do flashcards and memorize words. That's what Jane and Dick or whatever. That's what that was all about. Memorizing words, flash words. And that this was a change agent idea that would create dyslexia and dissonance in young people. It would break down people's ability to read in a very comprehensive way. Now, you know, it almost sounds bizarre. How could this be? How could we have our great so-called progressive educators deliberately and consciously, because they know what they were doing, consciously disrupting our ability to read, our children's ability? Why would they do this? I mean, I don't think most of these people were witting and conscious in terms of what they were doing. But they were doing it anyways. I mean, we could get into a dissertation of why. I mean, my personal friend, the late Dr. Samuel L. Blumenfeld, devoted a large portion of his life studying the subject and wrote many, many important books on it, which I urge you to look up. his classic is NEA, Trojan Horse in American Education. And Sam was a great researcher, and he kind of introduced me to this. Boy, I miss Sam. I wish he was. I mean, we did many hours of radio together, including here at Tufts. And he passed away. I think it must be about a year, at least maybe 2 years ago. Anyways, I don't want to get off on a tangent here. Suffice it to say that the modalities of teaching damaged particularly a black community where you did not have two parents at home, where you did not have employment, where you had a compromised church. You know, you couldn't help a young person as easily. You didn't have the resources. You didn't have the understanding to do that. You were more dependent on these rotten public schools to do it. Whereas some, I don't know, more well-to-do suburban white kid, their parents could get tutors. Their parents could make sure they could read. They could oversee it, even though it was also damaging to them as well, frankly. The result is that your generation come up who could not read well. You know, if you go to like prisons, frankly, and I think that Sam Blumenfeld actually did some research on this and he had some statistics. You'll see that a very high percentage of the prison population, particularly the black prison population, they are virtually illiterate. They can't read because they were given these cockamamie reading methods when they were in school that scrambled their brains. And they were meant to. They exchanged the ability to cognitively read the language to a behaviorist approach where they had to memorize thousands of words as if they were pictures. Of course they had dyslexia. Of course they shut down. Of course they had ADD. Right? Of course they had behavioral problems. If you can't read properly, you cannot be an independent person. You can't really take in something on your own. You're dependent. You become, in a sense, frankly, a ward of the state. And so, sure, they started acting out. Sure, they started to become violent. Why wouldn't they? I would have. I did, but let's put that aside. And so the result, what do they do to respond to that? Well, our psychiatric community, with their scientific, cloaks and their claims of scientific knowledge, which I highly question, by the way, their solution was to put these kids on drugs, psych drugs. Read the fine print of those drugs. The fine print includes homicide and suicide. And other deleterious after effects. And so you have a generation of drug addicts. You have kids dealing the drugs on the street. And you have kids killing other kids like they did in Columbine and elsewhere. And by the way, I don't want to veer too much into that subject, but the Columbine massacre really shocked the country. These two kids showed up at the high school and they just machine gunned to death their classmates. We know what happened. I don't remember the number, but it was a horrible, large number of kids who were just mowed down and murdered by these psychopaths, of course, but they were both on these drugs. I don't think there's any getting away from that. And every other case, as far as I know, and I don't know if it's every case, but you have to take a look at similarities. These young people on these drugs. It's not just young people. The guy who machine gun the concert of Trump supporters in Las Vegas. He was on those drugs. This guy who machine gunned Trump supporters at a church in Texas, he was on those drugs. Yeah. Now, is that why he did it? No. But there is something that's happening in this country that's different. That wasn't happening before. It's an epidemic. And we need to look at it. It's ugly. But getting back to my topic, because we're reaching toward the end of the program here. The black community was demoralized by left-wingers and their ideas. And now they're turning around and accusing us of having something against black people. You know, the last line of defense in after all is said and done, after you have the destruction of the family, the destruction of the economy, the destruction of the church, and the destruction of education, after all that, the final line of defense, the final group that actually wants to help black people in the inner city are the police. Who else? They're the ones who are going in and trying to actually conduct gun control in its true essence, which is taking away guns that are illegally held by criminals and thugs who are terrorizing communities. They're the ones who go in and try to handle the consequences of left-wing policies in those neighborhoods. They're the only ones who actually believe in the real sense, in the sense that they're putting their own life on the line, they're putting their own skin in the game, that they actually believe that black lives matter. Take a look at Chicago. Take a look at the violence against black people in Chicago, mainly carried out by violent thugs who have been let out of prison because of a criminal justice system that gives them a pass, who have been socialized under welfare and drug abuse and anti-church, anti-capital attitudes, and who are now terrorizing the 99% of the people that live in those communities who want to get on with their lives, who are trying to conduct their lives and take part in the American dream. The police are the ones who are going in there as the last resort to try to maintain a level of law and order that would permit people to advance and to get out of this left-wing hellhole that our establishment created. And now what's happened? They're under attack. They're criticized. I'm not saying they're all perfect, but I can tell you that since I've seen these riots, I've developed a respect for policemen that I didn't have before. I've really thought about and realized how difficult their job is. And so you have genuine culpability on the hands of the left for some of the social problems that the black community experiences in this country, possibly other minorities as well. And so they turn the tables and they say, you have something against black people because one time you put, you know, cotton in an ornament or something at a function that you attended, or you know, you looked the wrong way. They put everybody under a microscope. You notice they don't put themselves under that microscope. This microscope couched in scientific mumbo-jumbo and smart-sounding euphemisms is only used against their enemies, those who actually want to help black people, those who believe in capitalism and God and individualism and genuine education and other institutions that actually can empower people Those are the ones who they go after. So they go after Donald Trump. They call him names. Here's a man who built a business that has employed thousands of people. Here is a man who had a business that the New York Times showed up with reporters because they said, oh, they must have all white people. You know, they hate blacks, you know, right? And they discovered it was the most diverse company they could imagine. So they didn't say anything about it. They like to talk about equal pay for equal work with women. Well, the Trump Organization does this, unlike Obama in the White House and unlike Hillary Clinton's State Department. They actually pay women equally to men based upon their ability, based upon their, you know, in the same, you know, they judge each individual for who they are. And they happen to, by the way, have a large number of high-level women executives, unlike most companies. So let's not talk about that. But so they use this pronged attack. He's got something against Muslims. Why? Because he's concerned the same way most presidents, even Obama, with the possibility that those who are at war with us, the jihadists, might infiltrate into immigration and come into this country and harm us. There's something wrong with that. You have to solve that problem. You know, I mean, it's like during World War II, would we have opened the borders to Nazis? Right? I mean, this is, you know, these are select people, and certainly not all Muslims, thank God. But it's select people that are there and that are at war with the United States. Look at this guy who just drove a truck in Manhattan. Should we just sweep that under the rug? Right? He was here legally. I'm sorry, but that's a war, you know, and it's a war that they're open about and they've declared. And we have to come to grips with that. We can't sit around and worry about this business using this as a political football. Say, oh, he's got something against this group of people. That's nonsense. Anyways, looks like we're reaching toward the end of the program. So I guess let me just make a few program notes here. I am doing on a daily basis, or almost a daily basis. I don't think I can do it every day. I certainly can't do it most weekends. But I am trying to do at least 3 or 4, if not 5 a week, of podcasts. And those podcasts are available both on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and TuneIn and several other servers, as well as on YouTube. Now, this is not a for-profit thing, so I think that it's okay for me to say this on WMFO and on my affiliate station at Boston Neighborhood Network, since I've been told that I'm not allowed to sell products. I'm not selling a product here. There's no money exchanges hands. I'm simply making this statement to let people know how they can view some of the things that I do, which are not profitable to me. There's no money. Maybe at some point that might change. Who knows? I'm not holding my breath either on that. You never know. But as of today, there's no profit for me. None. I haven't made a nickel on any of it. But what I'm doing, the reason I bring it up is because I do this daily podcast. As I said, it's available at YouTube and at the other servers. And you can look it up by putting my name in this in the Google, that being Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code. Or look up Left Right Radio with Chuck Morse. The reason I call it Left Right Radio is because I'm trying to, and in fact I am, beginning to schedule in liberal guests. I want to debate people. I want to bring back this dialogue that's become so rare in the society, particularly since Trump's election. Left-wingers don't talk to me anymore. They used to. I mean, I did a whole series with Noam Chomsky. The other thing I want to mention is my column, which, again, I'm not paid for. There's no money. Exchanges hands, so you can keep this on the air. And that is available at Newsmax.com. It's the Chuck Morse Letter. I write a weekly column.